the Sketchy Podcast. My number is 14.
I'm Mr. B.
Today we're going to be talking about, I don't know, human tragedy in the world of science and experimentation and just stupidity, I suppose. I don't know. You're going to witness a lot of dumbitude. This show is just all about kind of irrational stupidity with one little ray of hope in all of that idiocy. One brilliant young man who's going to make you feel as though the future has, a chance. But first, what are you drinking? Well, today I'm actually drinking something a little different. I'm drinking Sapporo, the Japanese beer that's actually, I think it's manufactured here.
Right? Sapporo.
Sapporo. One of the things that might surprise our listeners is how much Japanese people love beer. You might not even know. You might not think about it.
I know.
Oh, they
I
drink, know. What do they drink? Just tea over there? No, man.
In the mornings.
So much alcohol is consumed in Asia that over here you think there's a culture of drinking, but no, there's just a culture of college students having a couple of drinks.
Yeah.
In Asia, it's business people that are basically sororities.
It's the business culture of like drinking with your boss and sometimes taking shots so your boss doesn't have to. Minimum 8 hours of karaoke a week kind of thing. And the beer isn't that strong, I have to say, but they have other stuff. They have
well, the beer is the opener. They open with beer. Of course, it can't be strong.
No, and
it's drinking over the course
of several hours.
Oh yeah, it's just long.
It's completely exhausting. I mean, I don't know how they do it.
You have had a lot of experience because you travel to Asia a lot. And was there one fucking business outing where there wasn't an exceeding amount of pressure to drink? Like,
was there one? Yeah. I can't think of one. Okay. No,
it would probably have stood out, actually.
It was as important as the kooky business card ritual.
Oh,
and, yeah.
Tell them about the kooky business card ritual.
Well,
most people don't know.
It's a two-hander.
Oh, you got to spend time looking at that motherfucker, too.
Yeah, it's a two-hander, and it's a two-hand presentation move. I mean, look it up online. You'll see the whole thing. It takes about 10 minutes. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And so for everyone to give each other the cards. It's a two-hand acceptance as well, and you look and you
study.
Sort of study and make maybe some noises of being impressed, approving, and interesting. And,
maybe that's why you like that scene from American Psycho with the business cards. It's right up your alley, buddy.
It's right up my alley. But anyway, one thing you never do is like you never flip it over and jot down your phone number or anything.
Disgrace the card.
Crass like that. But it's funny. It's almost like a certain rite of passage. When you get to a certain level in a company, you will have earned having a card. And so, you know, it's sort of common for younger workers to say, oh, sorry, I don't have a card. And then...
Could that be a lie to avoid the ceremony, though?
It just may well be. But it's sort of weird to not have one in certain situations. Like, oh, you're not at the level where you have a business card. Well, may I speak to your boss, please? Kind of thing.
Sure.
So that just doesn't really happen. In fact, a lot of sort of contemporary workers in North America, if I can put it that way, don't want a business card. No one really interacts that way. It's almost a sign of being part of the old guard of the way sales used to be done, the way that business used to be done. Having a business card is not as relevant as having a good social media presence and a good LinkedIn account and a good, you know, a good electronic calling card.
Okay, so let's go back to the drinking because I want to know this. Typically, a North American worker, you know, they're working like 40, maybe 50-hour weeks.
Right.
But they go home and they can just chillax. Now, how much
they might
of
have
your...
a beer or two just to kick up their feet. Maybe on the weekend they get together with their buddies.
Or maybe on the
football.
Friday. Maybe on the Friday you go out. Now, Asia, how many nights of the week do you have to go out on extra business drinking shit?
Look, it's not everybody. It's not all the time. But it's certainly different from what we expect. And what we're used to in North America.
More intense.
It's very intense. And it's a very sort of homogeneous society.
Now, why do they do it? Why do they fucking do it?
And there are certain social rules that... Why do they do it?
Yeah, why do they do it? Like, why would you fuck yourself up so bad? I mean, I know they're stressed.
I think
it's... And like high fucking strong. But what the fuck, man?
I could be completely wrong. But from my my experience, I think it's a way for that culture to have some form of like bonding between people because there's a little bit of a repressed nature. It's a very structured and rigid
society. What percentage of women are involved in this kind of drinking ritual?
It's changing, you know, but from what I personally saw, it was mostly men, and I guess it's changing like anywhere, but the attitudes are different. My sort of perspective was it was like almost viewing certain elements of the 1950s America, the black suit, the sort of Mad Men style office dynamic between the sexes. Mm. And again, I'm not trying to stereotype anything here, but like it was a palpable difference. It was very, very different.
It just seems like a complete waste of life and liver, honestly. I mean, I am very suspicious of drinking with office people because that shit just comes back, man. Like, you can't keep your mouth shut.
I suppose if you're trying to reach, you could say it's part of like the notion of working for a company for your whole life and being part of a second family. And these people you're going to be with them like basically for your whole career. So might as well drink with them kind of thing. But I don't know if that's it, honestly. I think it might just be something deeper, like some sense that people just don't connect. They feel alone in some of the biggest cities in the world. And drinking is a way to feel different, to feel a slight tinge of
humanity.
Humanity, yeah, just to open up.
Yeah, as isolation becomes worse, we drink more.
Yeah, so those are just like raw, unfiltered kind of perspectives there. But yeah, it's different. You got to drink a lot. You got to drink a lot.
Yeah, see, that's why I'm like, I don't want
to. I'm like a Tuesday.
I don't want to do business in Asia. Like, I mean, I'll drink for the show and maybe I'll consume like 3 or 4 beers. That is it. Like, if I start having more, I mean, no. It's going to be a mess. Like, I can't handle hangovers. I'm not a fucking 20-year-old anymore.
Well, Korea, they drink a lot. I think it's one of the highest rates in the world.
Is it right?
Yeah, like people will pass out on park benches all the time. And,
Jesus. Yeah, I've had
stuff
that
called
once,
soju.
I soju. Passed out on a park bench once. That was embarrassing.
China, it was a lot of whiskey I found in China and traditional wines and stuff. The kind of place where they would plunk down a bottle and mark it off with a marker, and at the end of the night they'd sort of measure the current level versus where the marker was at the beginning, and just charge you by the like centimeter of whiskey.
All right, that's one way. They could have just weighed it, for God's sake.
A lot of strange karaoke style singing too, like a bit intense.
They do love their karaoke.
They take their fun seriously.
Yeah, I guess so. But like I said, you know, that's not for me. I'll drink socially, but getting sloshed or having to prove yourself. But, you know, you pointed out something that I thought was interesting. I've had this on my mind, too, as of late, when you said that they needed some kind of ritual. And, you know, we're in a society these days where we have very few rituals that we actually kind of rely on. And if you look at the history of mankind, I mean, we were awash with ritual. And one of the most important of all of those rituals, something you can still see in, let's say, Stone Age tribe, was basically a rite of passage for manhood. Because let's face it, all right? I mean, you achieve manhood, quote unquote, when your dick can start getting hard. But when you were 12 and you got your first boner, were you a man?
And that makes it really awkward to share that experience with your fellow man.
It's usually. Like you break over, you know, open your parents' like room. You're like, I had my first boner, and they were like, oh, that's so great, let's have a party. No, I don't think so. All right, that's not happening. So I guess that throughout our history, we obviously understood that the status of being the man is contentious, right? Like, there's always that alpha male kind of battle. Who's the man? I mean, when I say the man, what is the first thing that pops into your mind, right? It's like this image of a cool guy who's in control or something. You know, the alpha dude. This is what you think of when I say that. So, naturally, that's a pecking order. It's got to be, you've got to discover who the fuck is on, you know, the top and who's at the goddamn bottom. So, we've always created these rituals, and I think that the sad thing now is that all our rituals are doing are making the fucking alcohol companies richer and us poorer in the process. Because you really think that your ability to fucking consume alcohol says anything about your qualities as a man? I'm like, well, unless he got super violent, then you know, we found out that he had really good kidneys.
Yeah, alcohol is funny, eh? Like, because it does sort of bring people together. It lowers inhibitions. It feels really good for the first couple drinks.
First couple.
And then you sort of feel invincible, and that momentum carries you through to the next several drinks, and then you just have nothing but regret. You know, that's sort of the cycle that people go through.
But that cycle is actually, like, we can actually track the brain, and it's just a matter of chemistry, because the first few drinks, are releasing all of this energy, this sort of like this feeling of euphoria and energy that you have. Sure, that's we know this about alcohol. But then, like anything, you know, when you punch yourself, and then all of a sudden it hurts at first, but then you get that rush of adrenaline. It's like the opposite of that.
Right.
Now you're too happy. Well, let's bring you down, bitch.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess everybody needs some kind of outlet. You know, sports feel good because you're just working, you know, out your energy in a different way. Drinking can feel good, I guess. And you
but
know,
there's a reason why a lot of sports are themselves kind of rituals of manhood. I mean, like, why do you think so many of our contemporaries, so many of our schoolmates, Tom, joined sports programs? No doubt it was to get some kind of fucking feeling of belonging and trying to prove yourself and what have you.
Yeah, there's definitely something ingrained to wanting to be active and moving around and stuff.
One of the things that I find really fascinating about Asian culture in general is, and you'll notice this if you watch a lot of anime or you read any stories that are written by either Chinese or Japanese people, and you will notice that there's an obsession with levels. Like,
right,
a good example is, like, you'll have fantasy
hierarchy
where all of a sudden a guy will be a level 50, but he's fighting a level 99, and you keep thinking to yourself, why does this fucking matter? But if you've played a role-playing game, the entire structure of the role-playing game centers around this hierarchy system.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because if you look at, let's say, China's history, China had a literal bureaucratic religion. So depending on how much money you paid, for instance, it would guarantee a specific level of hell that you would face. So everything's kind of bureaucratic, and it makes sense. If you've got a couple hundred million people back in the Stone Age kind of thing, you've got to really organize them pretty well.
Do you think that kind of sort of leveling or stratifying or I don't know, this emergent hierarchy is coming from just the fact there are so many people in one place?
I think that's a huge part of it.
You know, like the population is so dense that how can a structure not crystallize in society?
How can't, like, you need to tierize people based on sort of like certain skills. Okay, you're level 60 Taylor, you're a level 99 warrior. Because otherwise, how the fuck can you tell the difference in a room with like 1,000 people? Who are the scrubs and who are the fucking winners?
Well, you know, maybe it's also a coping mechanism to explain, like, a lack of individuality. You know, you're a drop in the bucket in these massive societies, massive cities. And if you're wondering, like, why am I not as rich as that guy, or why am I down on my luck or something, you know, explaining it in terms of levels, how the deck is sort of stacked against you right now, or you just haven't accomplished enough to gain a certain amount of power, it's at least a rational explanation for your lot in life.
Yeah.
Right,
and it gives you hope that you can raise that.
Exactly, it explains where you are today, and it gives you some kind of very clear ladder that you could potentially follow. And I don't know, like I guess for all the knocking we do towards, you know, caste systems and these rigid level, we kind of make fun of these rigid level based societies or tiers or whatever. Maybe, like, the fact we don't have that sort of same system in North America explains why people feel, like, lost and lonely and, like, completely hopeless, you know, sometimes.
Sure.
Because they don't have that rationalization.
And imagine one of the things that is actually very common for intelligent people, and I'll use an example. Like, my roommate is very smart. He's a young guy. He's smart, but he is so worried about his own intelligence. He asks me, like, about it all the time, like, do you think I'm smart and that kind of stuff? And this is symptomatic of almost every intelligent person I know, because the smarter you are, the more you kind of worry about your own intelligence. It's that whole, you know, what is it, Dunning-Kruger effect we keep talking about on different shows, where is, like, if you have very little expertise in something, you have a great deal of confidence. But as you begin to, as your knowledge base increases, you're fucking confidence goes way down.
Yeah, and being super smart, like, I don't know, in a general intelligence kind of way, doesn't guarantee success in the EQ
and
kind of
sense.
And you can
be definitely,
you know,
like, dumb in some fundamental ways, like, oh, I'm so dumb, I forgot to pay my rent. You know, like,
there's some practically exactly.
stupid people that you're like, you would look at this person and say, why the fuck didn't you pay your rent? But at the same time, they're able to solve, let's say, equations that for you look like goddamn hieroglyphics.
So I suppose, like, it's another way to rationalize how you can be really smart at one thing, but really dumb in the rest of your life, or really novice, beginner level at you know, and other things.
I think that rather than think of our intelligence in a general sense, we should just think about our actions on an individual basis. Did you do something dumb? Because odds are, even if you're smart, you're going to do lots of fucking dumb things.
Yeah.
You're a monkey dressed up in a suit. I mean, I can't stress this enough. We are so lucky that we're not shooting shit at each other, okay?
It's a super fine balance, though, because, like, what you hear in sort of popular culture, maybe for the past few decades, is you can do anything. You're precious snowflake. You're not special. Capable of being an astronaut. You already are a fucking astronaut in training, right? And you're six.
Well, we made a critical mistake of confusing unique and special. These are not the same thing.
And it sort of like obfuscates the fact that, you know, potential is one thing, but you do have a current level, if you will, and take any skill, any type of aspect of humanity
you can
kind of measure or compare to someone else.
Well, that's what we do. You know, we're measurers. No, we measure everything.
We're focusing so much on this potential thing that we've perhaps forgotten that potential is only meaningful if it can bring up your level, right? And if we only focus on potential, not the current level of where you are today, you're going to be disappointed. You're not even going to work on the right things. You're just going to think, all I need is courage. All I need is heart. All I need is to believe in myself. Yes, you need those things, but they're not all you need. You have to be realistic with yourself and constantly figure out like who you are right now.
Well, you know,
if you want to improve.
This is possibly the best segue we have to speaking about our first topic, which is the nuclear Boy Scout, is a story that came out in the 1990s. And the reason that I'm mentioning it now is that the guy in question, called David Hahn, died today. And he died at 39 years old.
That's right? Pretty young.
This is a fucking young age to die. And if you look at a photo of him, which hopefully we'll post up, he looks like he's a crack addict. He's got pockmarks on his skin. It looks awful, okay? He didn't look too good. So if you're wondering why he was called this, this is an example of what happens when you take someone who has a moderate amount of intelligence, an extraordinary amount of dedication, and I don't know how else to describe it, like just like
stick-to-itiveness.
Thank you. Yeah. Like how far that can take you in the wrong direction. Because you remember that you were probably told at one point that there's such a thing that, you know, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. Well, a moderate amount of knowledge can be an extremely dangerous thing. So let's talk about this guy to begin with.
So he's a Boy Scout.
Yes.
And he's working on his merit badge.
Yeah.
Himself up.
There are several science badges for the Boy Scout. One of them is atomic energy. And it turns out that because the Boy Scouts have like an unlimited access to all these companies or whatever, they used to do all kinds of things. They received a bunch of manuals from a number of companies, including, I'm trying to think if it's General Electric, but there's a couple of companies that actually have nuclear reactors that gave them and created reading material and study material for people who wanted to kind of build models, if you will, of nuclear reactors.
You know, I haven't really looked into that thread of this guy's story too much, but I wonder if it was part of that general campaign to paint the nuclear weaponry industry as something that's friendly and useful to society,
the reactors, and the campaign to get
kids sort of thinking about atomic energy is you know just another merit badge, right?
And in fact, a lot of the material stated plainly that people's mistrust in nuclear energy was going to cripple America's future, and that this was something that was open to the public. And they say that, look, in a democracy, the population get to decide for themselves what happens. And, you know, an educated population on nuclear energy is a healthy population. And it turns out that that's not really altogether that true. So now you could say that he was trying to gain his merit badge in nuclear energy, but here's the truth. He already had it. So this is more about a kid who he was facing divorced parents, living with his mom and his stepdad, and trying to get away from them. And really, you know, he was very isolated at school, a terrible speller, a bad student all around.
So he took
trying
like,
to feel special.
He was looking at his relative levels, and he was like, 1, 2, 0, 3, they're not too 4. High. And on his Boy Scout meter, he was like, ah, I'm a solid 18. So he was like, that's my new identity. Well, I'm just going to go down the rabbit hole and keep going with that nuclear
stuff.
I feel
like this guy, if you were to give him levels like, okay, did you ever play Dungeons & Dragons?
Yeah, yeah.
So you know that when you play Dungeons & Dragons, you have a variety of attributes from strength to intelligence and wisdom and charisma.
Right.
And it all makes kind of sense when you think about it.
Atomic energy.
And you could just sort of say, well, where would he rank in a number of qualities? And there's one quality that Dungeons & Dragons never understood or even never knew. And that one is determination. Now, there is an aspect, maybe we call it willpower or whatever, that some people are unstoppable machines. Right. And we'll try to accomplish anything. A good example of that is the Coral Castle. Have you ever heard of this?
The Coral Castle?
It's a guy who built by himself a fucking gigantic castle made with rocks so large, we don't even know how he fucking built it. The guy had so much determination, he uncovered secrets of moving giant structures that we're still trying to figure out to this day. He did this all to impress a girl who didn't love him. So apparently that gave him an infinite amount of determination.
Right. You could call it transference.
Yeah, maybe.
From one aspect of his life to another.
But you know, at least level of energy to do this.
At least that was towards something that was rather benign, rather harmless.
I guess.
Could have impressed a girl, or at least gave him a nice, cool place to live.
It certainly did. Maybe. I guess it freaked her out. A little too much, but guy.
But it just goes to show you, like, that maybe there's a part of our developing adolescence where we're just looking to figure out who we are.
We want to prove ourselves.
We want to prove ourselves, and we if we start to really prove ourselves and stand out in a certain category, singing, sports, Boy Scout badges. That if we have maybe just a hint of success, we're kind of a loner without much else going on in life. In other words, we're not well rounded. Mm-hmm. That there's a risk that, you know, that guy is gonna spend all his time building nuclear stuff in his garage.
I mean, and when you look at this guy's history, right? So really, what started off as a very basic desire. So this is 1996, and there's the recession that's happening because the Japanese economy has basically collapsed. So this like any recession sends people into kind of a panic. And I don't know if you remember this, but near the end of the 90s, we were talking about peak oil and when we were going to basically run out, because everybody thought that basically by today,
right,
we were going to basically have achieved peak oil, and now oil prices were going to soar, the cost of everything was going to be out of control. And so
there was
a
renewed interest, probably lobbying by the nuclear atomic energy sort of group.
And David had read a lot of novels and a lot of information about specific types of energy programs that had been discontinued in the 70s. And these were basically called nuclear breeder reactors. Now, the kinds of reactors that we use today use effectively the same kind of bullshit steam, heat some fucking water to turn some turbines.
Yep, yep.
But the nuclear breeder was actually about creating a kind of super reactor, where what you do is you take one radioactive element, you surround it with another slightly less radioactive element, which is encompassed in another one as well, a kind of shell upon shell. And because of the ways that sort of like nuclear radiation, weak radioactive force works, you're kind of like creating a reaction where the, you know, like one nuclear material is turning into another, which is generating energy. It's basically like fission in a box, right? And you're just basically putting it on the side, and then you're saying it's generating a lot of energy. But the problem with this, because when you're looking at these standard reactors with water, I read that somewhere it's something like 20% energy efficiency that you're getting out of this radioactive material. It's not great. Nuclear breeders were saying, like, we can harness 85% of the radioactive material, and rather than have all of this waste, the waste is actually recreated, if you want, into a new radioactive material.
Right. So, like, there's some technical details here, like the first step down from the super pure substance to the next step is where you get the biggest gain.
Exactly.
Biggest bang for your buck, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like the slow burn of going through the entire chain of other materials just isn't how those reactors are built. But what you're saying is there's another way to do it where it's more like a rich reaction that keeps going and keeps going and keeps going.
But what do you think the problem with such a reaction would be? And why would they stop this kind of funding? I'm sure you could imagine what is a breeder which utilizes like a significantly more energy What could happen in that kind of situation?
Well, you get runaway problems. Basically.
So it turns out that almost all the reactors that were built in the early or late 60s and early 70s had to be shut down because every single one of them had a minor meltdown. And it could have gotten a lot worse because these weren't, you know, these weren't reactors that were full capacity. These were still experimental. And at the time, the energy they were producing was so expensive that, you know, they didn't even calculate how much it cost. But to put things into perspective, okay, because I read a lot about this, and you still have to understand that this was a very volatile time for, you know, the future of nuclear energy. And you could create a lot of fear from it because there was the Cold War going on and nuclear... You say the word nuclear and people fucking freak out. But the thing about these, the anytime you first introduce a technology, like let's say the first nuclear reactor produced not even enough energy to fucking light a light bulb. But if they would have stopped then and said, well, this isn't worth it, obviously we wouldn't have it today. You can't look at the cost of when the technology is first being developed and just assume, oh, it's worthless. Like you'd take the same attitude with fusion energy. You'd be like, well, it's going to cost too much. Fuck that shit. Even though it's like the future, man. In 50 years, you're going to be heating your house with fucking fusion energy, dude. But anyways, so these breeders are kind of like discontinued. And so this David Hahn guy reads about this and he's like, I think this is the future of energy. And he's not necessarily wrong. I mean, he's thinking oil is going to run out and now we need something else. But before he gets to that stage, he's got a lot to learn. So he figures, I need to try to gather enough nuclear material to see if I can actually start a reaction. Which in and of itself, I mean, like, unless you're crazy, I mean, why would you even want to start that at home? Oh, let me gather enough nuclear material that it starts to get really hot. But he wanted to do it, and, you know, like I said, he had an unbelievable amount of determination. So the first thing that he does is he doesn't have a lot of information beyond a couple of, like, little instruction manuals, and he's exhausted all of those. And for the most part, he's done so many experiments in his house before he decided to collect nuclear materials. I mean, he was producing his own moonshine. He was also apparently involved in several terrible incidents, one in which there was an explosion in the basement where, you know, he was compressing a particular kind of powder that was extremely volatile and exploded in his face.
So he is probably a natural builder, like sort of an engineering mindset.
His father was an engineer.
Yeah, and
it's not very surprising, I'm sure.
Like, it was sort of the dangerous combination of skills, being an outcast, having this merit badge thing, and probably a search for identity, and boom.
And the really fucked up thing, too, is that... So one of the things that he discovers in the books that he's reading is that nuclear materials are actually a lot more prolific than you might imagine. For instance, every smoke detector has a traces amount of americium. Am I pronouncing that right? I can never...
Americium?
Americium. Thank you. Which is only emits about alpha particles.
Americium. Using the right,
if you're using the British version of it, anyways. So it's very low in terms of radiation. I think it emits only alpha particles, so it's not particularly dangerous. But they still sort of like seal it up. So what he did at first is he started to collect hundreds of fucking smoke detectors, popping out the fucking americium, and then just effectively just piling it all together. And what he did was, the first thing that he did was he built what's called a neutron gun with it. Because his intent was to take other materials that he was also collecting, for instance, thorium, which is used in some Bunsen burners to light up brighter. So he bought hundreds of those, melted the thorium, then took a battery, sawed it in half, took the lithium, sort of like took aluminum foil, which is like one of the most useful things when you're building a nuclear reactor, apparently, and he rolled it up in a ball, heated it up, and then the rest that was left was this highly concentrated thorium ash, all right, that he started to sort of like collect. And then he used this neutron gun to effectively turn the thorium into uranium, okay? Like, are you starting to realize how fucked up it is that a person can take basically a little block of lead, a shitload of, smoke detectors, a piece of aluminum or beryllium, depending if you want to really fucking knock it out of the park, and then effectively have a device that allows you to take one moderately radioactive material and turn it into a super radioactive material that is highly concentrated. And he collected so much material that at one point he was getting nervous because he could detect it a block away in his Geiger counter. It was going through concrete. Like, here's how bad it is. When they shut it down, and they had to fucking shut it down because one day he went for a drive with a toolbox that contained many of the radioactive elements and a couple of those aluminum balls of like thorium, driving around, and he gets pulled over by a cop who examines this, and then they're like, is there a fucking nuclear bomb in here? They don't know what the fuck to expect.
Right. Yeah, there are detectors out there with law enforcement. And
well, but they didn't know the extent of how radioactive it was, so they tore
why
it back.
Why take a chance?
They tore it back to the police station, which is the worst place you want to put a potential nuclear explosive device there.
Drive it out to a field, man.
Like, why would you put it in the police station? The epicenter of, you know, the law enforcement in your city. Hello? Okay, so yeah, that was a bad move. But after a while, when they opened it up...
But before we get... Let's just pause for a second. Sheer amount of just determination.
Just determination. Yeah, I cannot believe
it. Like, sure, he had the know-how, but he had the...
Hundreds of...
The motivation to go buy hundreds of smoke detectors and melt a bunch of freaking batteries.
No, listen...
That's insane.
He had his own safety protocols, though juvenile they were. Every day, he would throw away his clothing, because obviously they were irradiated, and he would wear a lead poncho, and he thought this was enough, you know, and like, he'd cover his mouth. Because, again, he was dealing mostly with radioactive material that at first emit mostly alpha and beta particles, and if you know those, you know that, you know, your skin and a piece of paper can fucking fend off most of that radiation. The problem starts when you inhale it and when you ingest it. Now, because he was working with fine powders, okay? Like, imagine a ball of thorium that you've just turned into a fucking powder and now you're mixing it up. Do you think maybe, just maybe, it went into your fucking lungs there, pal? Okay? And then you're just making a hot ball of uranium with it. Just like he never achieved critical mass. Thank God. But he worked in this little, like,
who do you call if you achieve critical mass by accident? Who the fuck do you call?
There are many different nuclear agencies. One is called the Nuclear Regulatory Agency, the NRA, I think.
But they're not, like, down the block like the fire department.
They are not, no. And the EPA typically gets involved if they don't get involved, which is what happened in this case, because when the cops discovered that the elements were radioactive, first of all, David did not cooperate with the cops, so he didn't tell them anything about his shed. He instead told them that he lived with his dad, which he didn't. He was living with his mom. In the meantime, his mom had basically thrown away in the garbage, yes, you heard me right, almost all of his materials. So we're talking all the thorium and all the uranium. So when the EPA got there and had to basically destroy his shack, and I mean like tear it up because it was so radioactive that just a fucking soup can that was there had 50,000 times like the normal dose of radiation that you get from cosmic rays, which is not insignificant, okay? So, I mean, it was a little radioactive in there. They had to bury every single fucking piece of that garage underground, along with like the shit they normally fucking bury in like nuclear sites, because unfortunately the half-life of most of the materials that he dealt with, apart from the uranium, is about 400 years for americium, I think, like for its radioactive isotope. I mean, that's not insignificant, okay? 400 years. And he put like they estimated he put about 40,000 people at risk with his little fucking experiment of Mr. I didn't achieve critical mass guy. And so today he's dead, and we don't know to what extent there was radiation poisoning because he refused to take any medical examination. He said, oh, it can't be that bad. I'm sure I've only taken 5 years off my life from all this fucking experimentation. I mean, did you not read up on the Curies, buddy? Did you not
right,
read up
right.
on it?
Right, right. And just the psychology of what's going on.
Jesus Christ.
You know, it's...
What was he thinking?
It's probably like, this is who I am. I'm going to do this better than anyone else, and I don't need your medical help. Like, sure, I'll take 5 years off my life. I'm awesome. It was worth it.
Well, he seemed to have an infinite
people do all kinds of self-destructive behavior, and a lot of it is less educational, I suppose, for what it's worth. But what a dangerous thing to play with.
Well, you know what he became obsessed with, actually, in the few remaining years of his life, though he didn't know that it was the last years of his life. He became very interested in biology and in amino acids. Like, you know...
Yeah.
Who knows what he would have concocted in that fucking world, Mister? I have an infinite amount of time. I know how to social engineer people, and apparently, I have no filter telling me that this is a crazy bad idea.
Yeah, yeah. You know, here's to the crazy ones, I guess, or the risk takers, the renegades.
But do you say okay? So let's segue on to our second topic, which is a kid by the name of Taylor Wilson, who was inspired actually by this nuclear Boy Scout, and he wanted to build his own reactor too, because he had many of the same feelings. He knew that basically energy was the future. Of course, he was a lot smarter because he decided, I'm not going to build this in my home because that's going to be a really bad idea. Yeah. Instead, he contacts a university. I think that's a smarter way of going about it, because he had read about different kinds of reactors. I think this one was called a salt reactor. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, like a molten salt reactor.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
And but his idea was like more energy independence by smaller reactors rather than a large one. Which
right,
is an intriguing
and that was
idea.
Like the high level design of sure, what he had sure. in mind. But his tactic was, hey, I'm gonna get a grant. I'm gonna be a young kid who approaches a university and the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in the States. That he's gonna do it in. Above board, you
right,
know,
but
like
look
above
at
board
done.
Nuclear reactor.
So what his career before that was, he was already winning science prizes with like thousands of contestants. So he's a boy genius, sure.
Oh, for sure,
he's
for
gonna
sure.
get a grant.
And you might
but
argue,
David Hahn could have never gotten a grant. I mean, he's a joker. He couldn't even pass English, for God's sake.
And you know, this is arguable because he clearly had some kind of talent for tinkering and building stuff.
Of course, no
doubt. Maybe in the right environment, given the right tools.
He would have been a great engineer, I think.
Builder of some kind. Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
And, you know, maybe he just didn't have, for whatever reason, the right support. And this Taylor Wilson kid, he's not a kid anymore, but he clearly had good support around him. He had connections to the good universities and access to the right people.
And he also didn't try to build it in his backyard.
No, I mean, he got it going, right, in a university and or in an Oak Ridge National
Laboratory.
Well,
he was also smart. He's like, I'm going to create a design and then sell that design. Rather than, I'm going to build a scary nuclear reactor in my house and then question mark? I mean, like, seriously, Mr. Hahn, what the fuck was your plan? Like, if you were to build just not even a nuclear reactor. Let's pretend you found some other energy form, like you use a zero energy reactor or whatever. Like, what the fuck are you doing with it? Like, seriously, are you just gonna plug it in your house and then like, I'm energy independent? Like, what's your end game? Like, what the fuck are you trying to do with this? Because unless you have a good plan, just building something is not really that great.
You know what?
Idea.
Yeah, I think this is a point that seems to come up over and over again when looking at the mistakes or the triumphs of humanity. Like, it's not just what you do.
It's why you do it.
It's why you do it.
Yeah.
You know,
the
story behind it, the goal, the motivation, because it's gonna dictate everything that comes after.
Well, the one thing that I think that nobody really understood, or perhaps, I guess before we close up the story and talk about the second one, I kind of wanted to mention the fact that I found very few videos that talked about this in terms of its security risk. Look, I'm not the kind of guy that sort of like says, hey, there's a terrorist at every corner. But one of the things that is probably going to be a big problem in the future isn't just like a terrorist having a bomb is not the worst thing in the world. A terrorist having a dirty bomb, that
right,
is the
right,
big
right.
difference. And so if you examine the way in which this kid was able to produce radioactive material of some significant quality, then you're like, well, it wouldn't be really that hard, if you will, to just do that same thing. And really, the importance of the difference between a conventional bomb and a dirty bomb is you just attach a bunch of fucking radioactive materials to it and hope it particleizes all over the motherfucking place. Because you can take, if a place is irradiated it's basically dead. Like, you get out, you get the fuck out of there. You're fucked for a million years in some of that shit.
Yeah, like concentration and the grade, the quality is really what counts. And we're talking like exponential, on a sort of an exponential scale. So something that's, you know, 10 times worse or 100,000 times worse is, you know, very different. But looking at those two samples, you know, in a dish, they would look the same to the naked eye.
Right.
Right. So we're dealing with like a different beast. And, you know, you're right. Hopefully the detection systems that are like plugged into, I don't know, people making purchases for this kind of material online or walking into a hardware store and trying to buy a crate full of, smoke detectors. Hopefully that raises a few alarms we get to that point.
Look at one of the ways in which this was so fucking brilliant. So one of the ways in which he got beryllium, which is one of the key elements in his neutron gun, was there's a certain amount of beryllium in sights in a gun. So what he did was he would scrape it off and he would send it back to the manufacturer saying that it was defective and get back more. And then he continued to do this until he had enough to sort of like...
Wow, someone was sleeping at the repair shop at the gun factory.
But I mean, like, there's so many...
Oh, sure, it's
that
kid who keeps...
There are so many different sources. And the truth is, if you kind of really understand the principle of how you can, again, transmutate elements, really all you need at that point is patience and...
Alchemy.
A little bit of fucking alchemy. Like, that's what's weird. Radiation is like the motherfucking alchemy of the world, dude. Oh, you want to change lead into gold? No problem. Take this fucking neutron gun and shoot their shit out of it. Well, it's not really a gun, but you know what I mean? Like, you will change the fucking physical property of matter. This is not magic.
Yeah, well, you know, chemistry, and it's blurring the lines of chemistry and physics. You know, we're at our energy scale, at the speeds we travel in, we're more used to chemistry.
Yeah.
But you know what?
That's all push a it, subset of that.
Push
fucking,
chemistry far enough, you're in physics town.
Yeah, you're in physics town, bitch. You obey our rules. Yeah. I mean, that's how it is. So just to wrap it up, I guess in a nutshell, what I'm trying to bring up in this whole experiment is that people with determination are scary.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how to deal with that fact.
Well, we've talked about people who had previous failures in life and then sort of found their niche. Like Hitler, for example.
Great. Yeah, it's not always great.
It's not always great. And, you know, molding and shaping people's success, maybe exposing them to successes that are good for society and showing them that it's important to have goals that are beyond their own tinkering, their own selves, their own gratification. Maybe those are good values to kind of push towards.
Yeah,
because
I'm like,
youngsters.
The whole time I was watching this thing, he's like, I was doing experiments. Okay, but you know, all the results of those experiments are known. So what the fuck is the point? Are you just trying to make yourself feel good that you can, you know, produce this particular kind of acid by mixing two components together? Good for you. But I mean, like, you're not contributing to the greater fucking good of science here. You're just experimenting for your own self-gratification. Really.
Yeah, well, it's funny, like the scientific method that they try to push at the sort of high school level includes a step at the very end that you must share your results with your colleagues and spread the knowledge so it can be tested and verified and basically put out there to the world, or else you're not really doing science. And it's true, like, peer review is really important, but I think it's also important not to only work in isolation.
But there's more to this story too, because
like Faraday worked in isolation.
Yeah, he was a bit of a dick.
You know, he found some really cool properties.
Yeah,
you know?
But he was a dick for not sharing
it. He did some neat, like, proto-science.
I guess. I mean, we're lucky that we found his fucking hidden notes, I guess.
I guess.
But there's another part to it, though, that I just thought of before I want to wrap it up. And it's basically the weakness of science was kind of, like, also in display here. Because what he did was he pretended he was a professor. And then, really, everybody just kind of fucking gave it all away. You want some secrets? Like, the reason he knew that beryllium was like 10 times better than aluminum in his neutron gun was because he had posed as a scientist and he was in contact with somebody from the Nuclear Regulatory Agency. So, and they were just basically in correspondence. So they were tutoring him. Now, I know that there's a part of us that says, well, science needs to be tutored, but not to fucking everybody.
Yeah,
it seems.
But okay, so there's science with like a capital S and science with a different lowercase s, right? There's science, the process, the philosophy, the framework, and then there's science, the culture of scientists.
Yeah.
You know, is those are really two different things. One can be socially engineered and one is something.
Well, one is
completely
just the raw facts. One is just the sort of the data
devoid
that
of any humanity.
Sure.
It's like it's all about
measurement and falsifiability. But it's the fact that it is devoid of humanity makes people less interested in it than the stuff that is filled with humanity.
It's possible, you know what I mean? But I think that would be like what he did there was your run of the mill social engineering attack.
Yes,
it could have happened in any industry, and it happens all the time.
Yes, but it gets
cybersecurity
scary
and telecom,
like the nuclear industry, and you're just hey everybody, maybe you shouldn't have taken this guy with a very moderate amount of intelligence and just basically given him everything, like given him all the keys to the castle.
From all the sort of social engineering talks and attacks that I've ever heard of. The one thing that keeps coming up over and over again that's rather surprising is, you know, if you go up to someone and say, hey, I want you to do this for me, that maybe 1 in 10 will do it for you. But if you go up to them and said, hey, man, like, I'm really sorry to ask, but can you help me out? I have this problem. I normally don't do this, you know, and you put someone in a position where they can actually help someone or they feel like they're helping someone. It works almost every time, or it's a much higher hit ratio.
Or there's also the fact that, you know, if you're looking for people to volunteer, you just, rather than say, please volunteer, you just say, here's a work experience for you to better yourself as a person.
The framing of things is different. But, you know, if he called up this agency and said, hey, I need you to give me some papers. I would like to request your data on, I don't know, the effectiveness of beryllium, for example. It might have worked if you got lucky, if you got some noob on the other end who wouldn't ask any questions. Or if, on the other hand, you're like, hey, I'm a high school, you know, I'm a new grad, I'm teaching this high school class, and I want to do this demo, but it's just not working out. Do you have any advice for me? You must have seen this before. Can you give me a hand? You know, he probably did something like that.
But a lot of the social engineering he did, too, was he pretended that he was a teacher and that he needed materials for students. And again, our instinct is like, education is good. And so our critical faculties
you don't want
of
be,
what's really going on here, gone.
You don't want to be the guy who didn't help the fucking high school teacher.
Sure.
Right? You don't want to be that asshole.
And I'm sure that at the time, they probably felt good. They're like, you know what? I really helped that school. No, you didn't. You made some 17-year-old guy like a little bit closer to making his ridiculously insane.
You just got him from a level 18 to a level fucking 19.
Like, actually, let me ask you this question.
Upgrade.
What really would have happened if his little breeder reactor would have reached critical mass? Well, the problem with reaching critical mass when you're dealing with heavier elements...
You can't just throw a blanket on it.
No. You cannot.
you can't.
It don't stop. That's
well,
the
your
fucked up thing.
Your house gone.
Like,
your block
you
gone.
Do you know why
your neighborhood probably gone?
Do you know why the core of the earth is as hot as it is? I mean, some of that shit is that reaction happening right now, keeping it hot, bro. So yeah, you can't stop it when it starts. So let's just say that we're glad that it never got to where it could have gotten, and. Let's just hope we never get to that point again. I mean, you say, I'm sure we have regulatory things. Do we? I mean, we live in the age of, like, the internet. I think it's easier now to get that shit than harder, right? More anonymity, more sources, more fucking options. Anyways, let's move on to our next topic, which is kind of like this idea that I just had, which is you should never go to Yellowstone and think that you should never try to hot pot. If you don't know what that is, hot potting.
Hot pot.
This is when some daring dudes decide that they're going to test fate and dip a little something in these really hot pools. And sometimes it might just be a finger. Sometimes it might just be a toe. And it doesn't seem like much. But there was a gentleman who recently decided that he was going to hot pot.
He got high and he wanted his temperature to join him.
And he put his finger in the water. But unfortunately, it's kind of hard to reach these things and it's very slippery. So he fell into the water. And so this water is unfortunately very acidic, very, very hot. So what do you think hot acid is like to the human body? Like, how do you think it reacts to hot acid?
Probably doesn't hold up.
Yeah, probably does not. And I have to wonder, like, Did he even have time to sort of struggle? Was the heat in the acid so insane that it's sort of like...
Puts you into shock right away and your brain shuts down.
I mean,
down
you don't even know what you're doing. You're flailing around. You're probably drowning. You forget
choking
how to swim.
On fumes and whatnot.
And everything's burning and you're probably screaming and then the water's getting into your lungs. And who knows what kind of agonizing,
what an
horrible,
awful death.
Yeah. It's not even... It's worse than what a lobster goes through, because when you put a lobster in boiling water, it's just water. It's not water with acid, man.
I just had a really vague idea. Like, I heard about this. It was on all the news sites and stuff. I thought he got high and he like gradually dipped himself in like into a hot tub.
No, no, no.
And he just stayed too long and he passed out.
Like,
I didn't know it was a slip and fall accident.
It's a slip, man.
Like, this is just another drunk person or high person who's putting themselves in a scenario where they have to have good reaction time and they have to be aware of their senses, and just they're in a high risk scenario.
Well, look, you're right in assuming it's like there are some people who die from what you're talking about too in Yellowstone. This has been known to happen too, because the springs won't always be mega hot. This is what actually kind of is interesting about them. They're almost timed.
It's so, like the frog in the boiling water
scenario.
The frog
scenario. In the fucking boiling water scenario. And so there are people, like even people who were workers formerly of Yellowstone National Park that have died, you know, going hot dipping or whatever. I mean, but the truly graphic thing about it, and the reason why it made all the headlines, is because when he first fell in and they tried to retrieve the body, they were unable to do so. I mean, keep in mind, you can't just jump in and, you know, I don't know if a stick will do. So they basically, they tried for a number of hours, but then they realized, okay, well, this isn't going to work.
But
we're
he was
try
like,
again in the
he
morning.
Was underwater and basically already dead.
He was dead.
Yeah.
And then they're like, well, we're going to have to fish this body out of the water.
Right,
we'll
do
it tomorrow. But I guess they underestimated the power of that acid, because when they came back, he was gone. I mean, like all gone, like completely dissolved, like Breaking Bad, fucking, you know, trying to dissolve the dude guy. Yeah, that's what had happened to him. He did this to himself. Now, I'm sure that he's going to probably be a contestant for this year's Darwin Awards. And, you know, if it was up to me, really, we'd give him that award. But I want to put this out as a public service announcement, ladies and gentlemen, that don't fuck with hot springs.
Well, yeah, and it's you know, the thrill-seeking... experience chasing, you know, youth culture and
the YOLO people.
The YOLO people. And look, the YOLO people is just a new name for a very old phenomenon. You know, when you're young, you want to do crazy things, you want to have awesome stories, and just some of them are freaking dangerous, you know?
Yeah.
Some of them you'll crack your head open,
do
some of them you'll dissolve in a pool of acid.
Do you know how many people die every year from fucking selfies falling over cliffs?
Oh, I can't imagine.
It's just nuts.
That's just bad.
I mean, like, imagine that's the last few seconds of your life. You're fucking falling to your death, and you're like, for a selfie? Oh,
I know.
Man.
It's
that hard. I was going to post on Instagram?
No, and it's, like, barely enough time to choose the right filter.
And think about this, too. Like, when you post to Instagram, to Facebook, you're actually working for Facebook. You are working for them.
Oh, yeah.
They're not working for you. You are creating this fucking bullshit content world, and you're just the little fucking cog in the wheel that keeps on feeding it. And part of your feeding it was led you to a ledge where you fell to your death. I mean, clap yourself on the way down here. You lived a life, eh?
And, you know, we're not trying to offend the family of these people who died or this person who dissolved at all. But I think we have to put our sensitivity on the shelf for a second. And actually talk about these real dangers. And if we do it in a joking way, so be it. But, you know, you got to get the word out.
Well, I don't want to nerf the world. I don't want suddenly you to build a fucking giant fence around this this water hole because a bunch of fucking idiots fell in. It's kind of like in, I'm trying to remember if it's Amsterdam. I forget which country where most drugs are legalized. There was a teenage kid a couple of years ago who took mushrooms and who jumped off a bridge. And they're like, do we need to make mushrooms illegal again? And you're like, what the fuck is wrong with you? One death from an idiot and now you want to nerf the world. I'm like, this is a wrong instinct. But the right instinct might also be to not ignore this situation and just suddenly say, okay, well, that was dumb. I mean, like, why did he do it? If we were to really examine the reasons, maybe we'd fall right back to what we were talking at the beginning, where you need rituals, and maybe it was fucking being dared. Hey man, you never did anything interesting in your life, why don't you hot pot here? And maybe this kid had never fucking taken any other chances, and this was the one time, and he fucked up. I mean,
it could be
noob. he'd fall right in. But you know, we all do stupid things. Like you, we have all done one tragically stupid thing that probably almost cost us our life. And we're just lucky enough that it never resulted in that. But damn it, man, it's almost like we should have a daily public service announcement. Dear stupid monkey in a suit, stop fucking up.
Well, look, like it's clear that we're, especially, you know, when you're growing up, you're predisposed to taking risks.
Sure,
you're absolutely figuring out. It's just like the previous story. Like you're gonna find that one thing that you think you can be awesome at, and you're gonna fucking go for it.
Well, it's more than that. So many times it defines you. Like I've been starting to read a book about the Palestinian crisis in Israel. And I was trying to understand sort of like how do things work. And one of the things that they mentioned a lot is graffiti writing. And graffiti writing is actually the equivalent of like newspaper writing in Palestine. So you'll have like public service announcements. You'll have threats against fucking snitches. You'll have all kinds of things being constantly posted up. And sometimes they're gone almost as quickly as they're there. But it becomes like your key to understanding what's going on. And all that graffiti, all of it, is actually produced by fucking 20-year-olds. And the reason is because it's illegal to fucking graffiti. And if you're graffitiing with a mask on, there's a high chance that you're gonna get shot in the ass and fucking killed. Now, how many people in society are gonna take those chances? Who the fuck are you gonna convince? Some 40-year-old guy with everything to lose, with a family and shit? Hey, buddy, you wanna go tonight and go graffiti? Nah, man. You get the 19-year-old dumbass filled with testosterone who wants to prove themselves and wants everybody to think they're the fucking big man on campus. Well, that's who you send. And they have their uses, man. The young men filled with testosterone, that's how you start a fucking revolution most of the time. A bunch of angry dudes there with like tons of energy and like this fucking David Hahn guy, an unlimited amount of motivation. Like, I don't know where it comes from. Like, deep down, I want to prove myself. Shit, man. You can break down a whole goddamn culture, a whole fucking civilization with that kind of energy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's dangerous, bro. All right, with that, my name is Mr. 14.
And I'm number B.
All right. Go to hell, everybody.